So before we begin the pod, we wanted to thank Representative John Lewis for the contributions he's brought to this country. John Robert Lewis was a civil rights leader that served the U.S. House of Representatives for Georgia's 5th Congressional District from 1987 until his death on July 17, 2020. He was one of the 6 leaders during the civil rights movement with Martin Luther King Jr. He led the first of the 3 Selma to Montgomery walks to Edmund Pettus Bridge that was also known as Bloody Sunday due to the violence created by state troopers and police that attacked the marchers, including Representative John Lewis, who was shot in the skull and survived. Representative John Lewis believed in standing up for what he believed in a nonviolent manner. Before his death, he wrote an op-ed and said, "Though I may not be here with you, I urge you to answer the highest calling of your heart and stand up for what you truly believe in. Thank you, Representative John Lewis, for your leadership and example. May he rest in peace."
Good morning, everyone. This is Maria.
And this is Shamira.
From What's Up Public Health. Today, we'll be talking about what is public health, schools reopening amidst the pandemic, and what it means for the U.S. to leave the WHO or the World Health Organization, and so much more. So stay tuned and join us.
And just a few friendly reminders before we begin the pod. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at WhatUpPH or email us at WhatsUpPublicHealth@gmail.com. And if you like what you hear today on our pod, please leave us a 5-star rating wherever you listen to us.
So the COVID update. So to start our podcast, we'll start with the COVID update. So according to the Worldometer, which is a website or organization that abstracts the data from State Department websites, the U.S. currently has approximately 52,000 new cases in one day, with California replacing New York with the highest number of cases in the state, followed by Florida in second with approximately 9,000 new cases today. And alongside that, the U.S. currently has 21 states that are in the red zone.
And I think it's really, I think you make a good point that it's important that I think there is some transparency with wearing masks and things like that, because some states are mandating it and other states are not. But in order to not just protect yourself but protect other people who are vulnerable, you should be wearing a mask whenever you can, just to try to err on the side of caution, right? You want to try to do those things, like I said, to not just protect yourself, but to protect others. It's that whole neighborly concept that we do need to think about our neighbors. So,
yes, I agree. And I think that it's definitely made things more complicated with states sort of doing their own thing, their own mandates. And in some states, even like in Arizona, having the city councils do their own mandates, because then everybody's really confused on what is going on and what to do and who is saying it right and who is saying it wrong. So it's definitely made things very complicated. But yes, yeah. Definitely wear a mask.
Yeah. And I was going to say, so here in the state, so I think that's a good point that you brought up, is that it's very different in Arizona than it is like here in New Jersey, because here in New Jersey, the governor kind of like signed, you know, like an executive order that everyone must wear masks when outside. It's now a thing. You can get like ticketed for not wearing a mask now. So it's very different depending on where you go. And, you know, it's funny that we're talking about this because I was thinking about planning a short little vacation to a few different places. And it's now so important that you look up what the COVID regulations are. Yep. Per state, because you don't know if when you arrive you have to quarantine for 14 days depending on where you're coming from or going to. So it just depends, right? So I think that's something to also point out.
Yeah, and even places going, there are some places that are closed in some states and aren't closed in other states. So If one is definitely going to go anywhere, one has to make sure that it's open and what they need to do for COVID. I think for me, and for public health, wearing a mask is the correct thing. It is a preventative measure. Staying 6 feet away as well is a preventative measure, but definitely there's other politics that say the contrary, but it's been quite a whirlwind trying to wrap your head around what is what and where to do what.
I agree. And I think it kind of goes into like what you said, like that, the public health of it, because here in the States, we're allowing each state individually to mandate their own rules and laws of what they want their people to do who live there, who reside there. Whereas in other countries, it's per country, right? They're not doing it based on what section of a country you live in. It's just the country mandated. And I think that's why a lot of other countries, particularly in Europe, have been doing so well with the COVID recovery. And I think it's just very interesting that we were seeing kind of like an uptick in April, and then we went down, and then now we're seeing an uptick again, because in other parts of the country outside of the original areas that were hotspots are now becoming hotspots. So a lot of other countries handle it differently, where the whole country shut down for 3 months and they were able to get it under control. Whereas here, I feel like it's gotten to a point where it's just a little bit uncontrollable at this point. So I think that kind of goes into like that public health topic of like, what should be mandated, what shouldn't. I also question sometimes, should things be federally mandated? And if that's what would help, but I don't know. It's just something to think about.
I think there is a priority list that countries have, and obviously economy is one of the priorities as a country, as well as health, the health of the people, and politics, and we'll go into the topic of what is public health soon, but this is a great example, is public health has a lot of politics involved in it. That is in every aspect in public health, you have politics involved, because you have a lot of policies. In order for change to happen, for public health change to happen, you need policy change, and for policy change, you need some politics to be involved. But I think when it comes to looking at a priority, like the state's priority at the end of the day, or a country's, the priority should always be the people. The people, I think, should always be first. And when politics is starting to get in the way and is starting to not help the people, I think that's when we really have to take a step back. And I think as the U.S., as a country, really needs to take a step back and sort of think, what are the priorities that we have? If it's to help the people, then we cannot be focusing on politics right now. And we really need to focus on the health of the people, which I think we in the U.S. are not having. We have very mixed feelings of what priorities the U.S. should have, and that has not helped. We should have a leader, obviously, that sets them forth, but that has been a little turmoil-ish too. So it's, and that jumps into our topic of what is public health very well, because public health is partially politics.
Yes. That definitely leads right into our next topic, Maria, which is what is public health? Many people in the general population are unclear about what public health is, what it means, what it does. And there are many factors also known as determinants of health that contribute to health and disease that are complex and interplay with genetics, environmental, and lifestyle factors. In addition, public health is a multidisciplinary enterprise that requires expertise in biology, pathology, environmental and environments, and earth science, psychology, sociology, government, medicine, statistics, communication, and many other disciplines. This complexity makes it difficult for many to understand what public health is and what it does. Another factor that adds to the public's confusion is that successful public health means that health problems are minimized or prevented. The absence of dramatic problems that require immediate correction creates the misconception that public health practitioners are not doing anything important. The life of a person who develops, for example, the life of a person who develops severe coronary artery disease after years of smoking, poor diet, and lack of physical activity might be prolonged by a dramatic and very expensive medical procedure such as a heart surgery. However, public health is about interventions that prevent disease from occurring. So the benefit tend to be less obvious. It should also be noted that prevention of disease not only prolongs life, but it also improves the quality of life. In a sense, public health is the heart disease that never developed, the epidemic that didn't happen, the outbreak of foodborne illness that never occurred, the child that would have developed asthma but didn't. In a sense, successful public health is the sum of all adverse health outcomes that never occurred.
Yep. And that's very difficult, I think, for people to understand, because we think of something of treating things. We don't think so much of preventing things, not as, I think, a whole. I think we're getting to that point where we're just like, yeah, let's prevent this, let's prevent that. It'll save us money, it'll save lives, this and that. But I don't think it's really something that's the fad right now. The common thing is that I want to treat. And because they're not seeing the problems we're preventing, they're thinking that, why should we give them funding if they don't do anything? Well, guess what? Public health helped invent vaccines and helped distribute them and prevent a lot of diseases. It was a teamwork between medicine and public health. But people forget that there was a public health component there. And that's where it's like public health doesn't even exist. And I think people need to see it as whatever public health focuses on the population. So whatever impacts the health of a population, whether it's pollution in the air, whether it's water being contaminated, whether if it's too much junk food or too much access to junk food and not enough access to vegetables, all of that is affecting the health of the population. And while it may sound very different to be like, oh well, environmental health or pollution is very different to obesity, yeah, but they both affect the health of the population, so they're both part of public health. And I think that's how people need to start seeing it, so they can at least try to understand it.
Yeah, and I think people sometimes don't even realize that personal hygiene was a part of public health too. And, you know, that came about for a reason as well, you know? So the spread of disease, if we think about that, right? Personal hygiene is what we talk about a lot with COVID-19, and it plays a major role in how this virus spread. So I do think that is true. There's a lot of different factors that play into public health. And I think we have to think of public health as being multifaceted, because it is. There's a lot of different roles that public health plays, and a lot of different, segues into public health from different, I guess, like, functions. So there can be politics, there could be sociology, there could be psychology, there could be biology, right? Epidemiology is a part of that. So I think that it's important for everyone to think about it as a bunch of different factors that play into one big cloud of public health. But I do think that it's important that we talk about maybe Charles Edward Winslow, who defined public health, right? He defined it as the science and art of preventing disease, prolonging life, and promoting physical health and efficiency through organized community efforts for the sanitation and of the environment, the control of community infections, the education of the individual and principles of personal hygiene, the organization of medical and nursing services for the early diagnosis and prevention of treatment of disease, and the development of the social machinery which will ensure to every individual in the community a standard of living adequate for the maintenance of health, which are all topics that I think we touched on just now. So I do think that even back in the early 1920s, and even before that, they were just starting to discover these things and understand what public health was. And they really were the catalyst to define public health. And, you know, we're still working on those strategies today, but it's laid the groundwork for what we need to move forward with emergency preparedness in situations like a pandemic, like what we're dealing with now.
Yes, and it's very, these are very unique times, because obviously you don't get a pandemic often. So I think that's a great example right now.
They won every 100 years, right?
Every 100 years.
Something like that.
We were due for one. There you go. We're 2 years late. And they, like education, access to education. That is public health. Pollution, like mentioned, pollution. Climate control, climate change, that's public health. Prevention of disease, that is public health. A lot of things are public health. Equity, social equity, systemic racism, all of that is public health. And I think people always get confused because they're like, well, that's systemic racism and obesity and infectious disease. All of that is so different. How is that all public health? I thought public health was one thing. Well, public health is one thing. Public health is focused on prolonging life and of a population, focusing on the health of a population. And a lot of things affect our health. So a lot of things are public health in theory. And one of the, but the most, I think the most common one we hear about all the time is prevention, like primary, secondary, and tertiary prevention are the most common ones.
Yeah. And I think that leads into our next topic, which is different types of prevention. And I think we should start with probably tertiary prevention, which is once an individual has been diagnosed and treated with a disease, subsequent efforts to reduce its effects would be regarded as a tertiary prevention. And examples of tertiary preventions are participation in a cardiac rehabilitation program by a person who has had a heart attack, interventions to promote exercise and weight loss in people who have developed type 2 diabetes, interventions to reduce allergen exposure in children with asthma. And then if we want to talk about secondary prevention consists of screening for disease in order to find subclinical disease and treat it in the hope that earlier treatment will provide either cure or reduce harm. So an example of that would be increased longevity, less pain, and less disability. And a few other examples would be getting a mammogram to identify early breast cancer, routine laboratory testing of blood and urine, could also include monitoring blood pressure to identify previously undiagnosed hypertension, and also prostate-specific antigen testing for prostate cancer. And so the last prevention is primary prevention. And the reason why I went over this one last is because I think it's one of the most important ones. The goal of primary prevention is to prevent healthy people from becoming ill. While this goal is laudable, it often creates ethical conflicts because perfectly healthy people are asked to take additional steps to prevent them from developing disease. Now, this is something that is happening now because we're asked to wear masks, we're asked to stay home, to shelter in place. And those are not things that people want to do because it means they will not be able to work. It means they won't be able to see their family. It means they won't be able to celebrate their birthday. It means they won't be able to celebrate their anniversary.
Yes.
So this is something that
it's
something that I think is important that we touch on less. Okay, so sometimes the actions that are desired requires people to do things they don't enjoy. For instance, exercise, or to forego things that they do enjoy, eating unhealthy food or smoking tobacco are examples. At other times, we ask perfectly healthy people to take steps that might put them at a small but finite risk. So an example of that would be getting vaccinated. And then just to go into a little bit about vaccinations have been enormously effective and reducing the frequency of many infectious diseases that were the scourge of mankind, but its enormous success has brought a dilemma. people were generally eager to be vaccinated and to have their children vaccinated when epidemics of infectious diseases like polio, measles, and mumps occurred frequently. Widespread vaccination enormously reduced the burden of these diseases by protecting those who were vaccinated, and because high prevalence of immunity diminished opportunities for from person-to-person transmission. This provided a significant degree of protection to those who would not or could not be vaccinated. Mm-hmm. So this, in turn, is herd immunity, because majority of the population has been vaccinated. So the likelihood of person-to-person transmission is low. The success of immunization greatly reduced the threat of this disease, with the result that the imperative for being vaccinated or having one's children vaccinated subsequently is diminished. With the reduced threat of infection, many people in the general population were more concerned with the potential adverse effects of being vaccinated. So that's what people talk about now. What are the effects of being vaccinated? I don't want to be vaccinated because it might have an adverse effect on my body. I don't know how it's going to react to me. So that's how a lot of people view vaccinations now. But as a result, we have witnessed a decline in the prevalence of vaccination and a corresponding increase in outbreaks of diseases like mumps, measles, and whooping cough, which is pertussis. So I think this is interesting to talk about, because I think this is something that we've been seeing relatively often these days being discussed, even within the medical community and in the public health community. So I don't know if you want to touch on a little bit of some stuff, Maria.
Well, I think vaccines are one of the best things public health and medicine have collaborated to create and to disseminate to the public and to make available to everyone. Not just to certain classes or anything, but just to everyone. And evidently, as it's being spoken of, a vaccine is what is going to help us return back to normal. That is, if we even can, because I'm so used to wearing a mask, I leave it on when I enter home. So, but I think definitely vaccines were one of the best creations that public health and medicine collaborated in creating. But I think there's been media, there's been marketing, there's been, obviously we all know, there's been academic journals and publications that have really left people scared. And I don't think that's how it should be. I speak for myself, having a sister with autism. It can get scary, and you can get that thing that, wow, well, what if it's your child? I mean, that's the most precious thing you have, and that you want to take care of and you want to nurture, and you just get this feeling because you hear it so much. And I think that's where it gets very tricky nowadays. And I think in COVID we're seeing it gets very tricky, because you're seeing so many people say so many things and science be a little bit distorted in which is correct and which is not correct. So, and then the politics comes into play, which then you have people taking political advantage of the situation, whether it's for to pass a bill or to pass something, but that's where it gets political. I think one important thing that to recognize from public health is the difference between a preventative measure and a screening measure. A preventative measure is to prevent you from having a disease. A screening measure is just to make sure that we get the disease early. We're not preventing a disease with a screening. That's not the point of a screening. The screening is to get it as early as possible, so one does not get an advanced stage of a disease, whether it's breast cancer or cervical cancer or an infectious disease, whatever it is. So I think that's really important to know, prevention and versus screening. And the politics is involved in public health. And public health is a healthcare profession, which I think many people get confused of and forget that we're also in the healthcare profession, because we focus on not individual health like medicine, but we focus on population health, which is also very important. The the other topic we have here is schools reopening. I think schools reopening is a good example of how to use preventative measures, how to use the primary prevention. In this case, it's been very tricky. I think school reopenings have become the debate of the last few weeks, if not months, I think. And while some say yes, others say no, for parents and even families like myself, it's really, the decision has been a nightmare. Planning for America for my sister, we decided to keep her at home, and it's been quite a whirlwind trying to plan everything out. It's definitely quite the nightmare. But the question that many have, parents from lawmakers, is the magical question of whether we open or not. And I would say it really depends. It depends on several factors. I think this question becomes so hard to answer simply because there are several things to take in mind. We need to take in mind community spread. Different states have different numbers. We need to take in mind the research on the spread in school-aged children. What does the research say? There is lack of research. There isn't much, but there is some research out there. And we also need to take in mind school funding. I don't think we can expect a teacher to pay for plexiglass, to get masks, to get gloves, to get sanitizing equipment, all out of their own pocket. If you ask me, that's a little crazy to ask. And we also need to take in mind the state itself, because you cannot do the same measures in a state in the East Coast versus the West Coast, because, for example, Arizona right now, it's 118 degrees outside. I doubt we can do school outside, because if not, they'll die from a heat stroke, and that's not good either. But I think one advantage we have as the U.S., as a country, if we use it wisely, is when opening schools, we have evidence from other countries that have already opened, like Norway, South Korea, Denmark, Israel, and many others. And we have success stories and stories that are not so successful. Israel is a good example of a story that is not as successful as others. So Israel actually had to close 2 weeks after opening because they started seeing an increase in COVID cases, with a single school getting 130 cases of COVID-19. So they decided to open up quite early. So they decided to open up when they were having approximately 50 to 150 new cases a day for a couple of days. And they declared it a victory against COVID-19 and opened schools the first week of May. Now, let's take in mind 50 to 150, the whole country, not a state, the whole country. So that is a little bit of cases. But they decided to open up the states when they opened up, when they put down all the other restrictions. So pretty much everything happened all at the same time, opening everything and opening up the schools. And their preventative measures included working in small group size that they called capsules. And a couple of weeks after that, May 17th, so yeah, about 2 to 3 weeks, they went back to normal, I guess you can say. So they started arranging the classrooms like before and just sort of motivating, wash your hands, this and that. And evidently they've seen an exponential increase in cases ever since, and they're still in the upward trend. So that was not the best school reopening. Now we have Norway and Denmark, which is very interesting because, similar to Israel, Denmark opened actually schools when they had a little bit more cases per day per the whole country. They had 50 to 150 new cases per day, with also a downward trend in infection rate. But what was very different was how they opened up the schools. So Denmark, on the contrary, opened up in a staggered manner. So in the middle of April, they opened up elementary schools and childhood care centers only. So this included also implementing prevention methods like smaller class size. Some of that even taught outside if it was feasible and not 118 degrees like Arizona. And additional classrooms were also available because they didn't put all the kids at the same time. They sort of staggered it in what grades could go in first. So they had a little bit more space to sort of spread out the kiddos if they weren't outside. And they also added sanitization areas where every hour the kid had to go wash their hands or put hand sanitizer on. Then later, May 18th, about a month later, is when the junior high and high school students returned. And so it definitely was done much differently, and still to this date, Denmark continues to only have 25 to 100 daily cases, and they have flattened the curve, as we say it in public health. And I think it is important to note that testing regarding Israel and Denmark, if we control for population, their testing is actually a bit better than the U.S. according to the Worldometer that extracts all the data from state and country health departments. So testing here in particular was controlled for. And I think the big point here is that we really need, when opening up schools, we need to take in mind how many cases there are out there in the state, in the city, but most importantly, how to open up is the big question. And even when looking at the American Academy of Pediatrics, they do recommend, the CDC also recommends, to try and get schools back open, but in a smart manner. Just opening up and sending kids back to school is going to result in chaos. Because we have to take in mind, you're asking kids that are between 5 years of age to 12, even 12, to stand still and be 6 feet apart. I mean, people can barely do that at Walmart or at Costco, let alone having 5-6-year-olds tell them to do that. So I think we really need to be careful on how we open. That's my take.
Yeah, I think I agree. And I like the idea of a phased approach. Because I think a phased approach allows you to see, okay, is it possible to have 20% of capacity in the schools, or maybe have half the students come half the week and the other half come the other half of the week kind of thing, and you only have like 20% of the normal capacity that's usually in the building, right? The rest will just have to work virtually some days. I like the idea of having a phased approach because I think it gives you a chance to see if there is going to be an uptick in infection. Can you locate where the infection might have occurred? I just feel like it's harder to do that when there's a lot of people in one space. You don't know where it's coming from. So I think in order to keep, I think that it depends on also, so I guess I should probably preface this by saying that is very much at the local level, those decisions sometimes.
Yes.
And sometimes it's at the state level. Some states will say, no, don't open your schools. But I think it's mostly at the local level. The local school districts are going to decide if they want the schools to open or not. For instance, where my nieces and nephews are going to school, they are looking at having the kids come half the week. So that is something that they're thinking about doing. Having half the kids come 2 days a week, and then they clean on Wednesdays, they do a thorough cleaning, and then the other kids would come Thursday and Friday, right?
Yes.
So they would have no kids there on Wednesdays. And I do think that that might work, but obviously we still have some concerns just because, you know, this area was a pretty big hotspot for a really long time, and there's still cases. I mean, it's not like it just went away magically. It's still around. So I think it's just concerning for most people to send their kids back to school. And then you also have to think there's a whole other side of this where there are parents who need to send their kids somewhere, back to school, back to daycare. And I think that is really challenging too, because you have parents who are working from home who are also trying to do their job, but they're also homeschooling their kids. So that is really, really challenging right now. And I think it's totally like a catch-22 here.
It's really difficult because you're trying to balance several things. You're trying to balance the emotional well-being and social well-being of the students, but you're also trying to balance their health, but you're trying to balance the parents that need to go back to work, the economic stability. So it's like a lot of, and I think that's what makes it really, really complicated, is that there's a lot of things to take in mind. It's not just one piece of data or two pieces of data. It's research, it's data, it's state and local level, it's politics. And it just gets so overwhelming and confusing. And if you don't know how to do it or have a team to do it, then it's like, oh my goodness, just open up schools because it's too much work, because it's a lot of work. Mm-hmm. But I think that some states, I mean, I think in the U.S. may not be able to open up. I think mm-hmm. right now some states have too high of numbers. Like California, for California, it's going to be much more difficult and maybe be much slower process than Vermont, who's seeing decreasing, who's the only state that's seeing a decrease in cases. Or even Arizona, where we can't teach outside. So we have to put everybody inside. So how are we going to do that when we have 32 students in a tiny classroom that their desk is 1 feet apart? So it's very, very complicated. I think we need to focus on sending students back, but I also think that health is the number one priority, so we really need to do it in a smart fashion and figure out how to stagger it. And I think we also need additional funding. We cannot expect teachers to pay for all these materials and to create all these preventative measures. There was a teacher that put a photo. She put plexiglass between four seats and I think it was like a hand sanitizer bottle or something under the desk or something, and it was literally just $100 for just four students. The average, usually teachers have between 28 to 32 students now. That's a lot of money for one classroom.
Yeah. But
hopefully we can try to figure out how to open it, and there is the CDC guidelines out there, and there is the American Academy of Pediatrics as well put a very extensive list and recommendations on how to open up too. So for state and local officials, I think I would recommend those two resources. And I think that sort of leads on to the other conversation, speaking of resources, is the World Health Organization. So I don't know, Shamira, if you want to talk about a little bit of who is who?
So a few weeks back, we got some news that the United States is, that President Trump is planning to leave the World Health Organization. And so we decided to do a short segment on what the World Health Organization is and what are the implications to us leaving the World Health Organization. So the World Health Organization was created in 1948 by the United Nations as the global health authority that would coordinate and guide health policy, practice, research, disease prevalence in participating countries. That means that any nation that participates in the United Nations can also be a member of the WHO. The international headquarters for the WHO is located in Geneva, Switzerland. And the director general of the WHO is appointed by the World Health Assembly, which is the decision-making body of the WHO and consists of representatives from the member nations. And the core functions of the World Health Organization are shaping the research agenda and stimulating the generation, translation, and dissemination of valuable knowledge, providing leadership on matters critical to health, and engaging in partners where joint action is needed, setting norms and standards and promoting and monitoring their implementation, articulating ethical and evidence-based policy options, providing technical support, catalyzing change, and building sustainable institutional capacity, monitoring the health situation and assessing health trends. So the WHO oversees six regions, and those are primarily North America, South America, Asia, Europe, Australia, and Africa. Mm-hmm. So those are the regions that it primarily serves. And there are several nations within that that are a part of the WHO. So I think, Maria, what we can talk about next is what are the implications for leaving the WHO? And I think you had touched upon a few things right before we started this pod. So if you want to go through, what are the implications for the U.S. leaving the WHO?
So the first one is that we owe them a lot of money.
Money talks.
Money talks, and we owe them quite a bit of money. You can't just... nothing in life is ever easy. You can't just get up and leave, especially when it comes to politics. Simply in just last year, we owe $80 billion, I believe it is, of just past due payments that we have not paid. I believe in total it's $198 billion that we owe.
So the United States is delinquent, in other words. Oh, we're delinquent on our bills.
Very delinquent on those membership dues. It's very delinquent. it's that in itself puts you in sort of, I think, a conundrum of, okay, we're going to be hit pretty hard after COVID and figuring everything out. How are we going to pay all this bazillion dollars of money when we're not even going to be in a good economic standstill after this whole pandemic starts to go in a downward trend? So that in itself, I think, is implicating. And the other thing is that we will get the end of everything, the end of the stick for everything. The World Health Organization provides leadership, provides that information and those resources, of whether it's materials, whether it's education to other agencies on what they can do. Just us alone as a country, it will be very hard. And it will also be very hard because we have international travel too. It's not like just us US and just we're the only ones we have to focus on. No, we have to focus on everybody that's coming in too. And that's international. What are we going to do if we just have the CDC? What if a pandemic is a great example? What would we have done if it was just us, just the CDC and the US? Where were we?
We would have gotten the news last, is what would have happened.
We would have gotten the news last. We would have gotten all the information and all the other research, probably, that everything that's going on regarding COVID outside the US probably last. So I think it's a very slippery slope and very dangerous to think that we're obsolete and the only ones in the planet and that we can do it all by ourselves. I don't think we can.
I think there's this mentality that we're this, you know, we're the greatest nation in the world, we can do everything. And while I completely agree with that, yes, we are a great nation, but we have done nothing by ourselves, right? No. We definitely need other countries and other people in order to help us survive. And it's just a matter of understanding that we all use each other's resources and we all need each other. If something's going on in another country, we don't live there. We don't know what's going on. We depend on other resources to get us that information, the correct information, so that we can properly prepare. I think that what happened here in the United States was just a matter of not being as prepared as we should have been for a pandemic like this. I think we need better emergency preparedness because we don't have those things in place. And I really think the World Health Organization tries to do their best to give everyone the correct information that they have, right? I mean, there's a lot of other things that went into why the things that happened with the pandemic. I mean, we could talk about the fact that the CDC also, we had to wait a few weeks for the CDC to even get tests to certain places. And then you have to get approval to get those tests. I mean, there were articles about that out there, and they didn't have enough tests for every state yet. That wasn't available. And then other countries had those tests before us, right? Yep. So, and one of the biggest things that I heard recently or read somewhere was that, you know, why wasn't a large manufacturing, you know, biotech manufacturing company hired to make these tests at mass production, as many as possible, so that we can quickly disseminate to hospitals and medical centers that would need them quickly. And I think something like that would have helped. I mean, now that they have all these tests available for places like California, Arizona, Texas, and Florida that are really seeing an uptick in cases, when this was first going on back in January to like June, even here in the Northeast, we didn't have those tests. For instance, you know, this is something very personal to me, but I lost my uncle to COVID-19 back in April, and they didn't have tests, a lot of tests back then. So he had to actually get approval to get tested. And by that time, he was already on a ventilator, and they just thought he had walking pneumonia, and it turned out he had COVID. And he went really fast. I mean, it was really quick. He was in the hospital, and then the next minute he was on a ventilator, and, you know, it just happened really fast. So my point is that I'm saying is that we need the guidance of the WHO, right? Because they are the health authority that's supposed to be giving the guidance on what should be done and how we should go about handling things and what's really going on in the world, what's going on in Europe, what's going on in Africa, how many cases do they have, what is this looking like. They were the first to declare this as a pandemic. At first it started as an epidemic, but then it grew massive. So we would have never have known about that right away. We probably wouldn't even have known that COVID was even on our doorstep if it wasn't for them, right? Alerting the United States that this was going on. So I think that that's something important for us to keep in mind, that leaving the WHO has a lot of health implications. Also for vaccinations, what if there's an uptick in measles and mumps? We wouldn't know, right?
Yeah.
So that's just something to think about.
Yeah, we wouldn't know. And the health status of other countries, while it may sound daunting to some people, does matter to other countries, like to the U.S. Because if there's an infectious disease or a rise of certain specific cases, like Ebola, like measles, mumps, and rubella, all of that, if there is an increase in that in another country, we need to know, because it can come over here. So we need to know what we have to do. And hopefully none of that will, hopefully we'll stay in the World Health Organization. We owe a lot of money, so my speculation is that we may just keep it as
is. We're delinquent on our bills.
Yeah, we're too delinquent. It's more than my loans, at least. My loans are a lot. My school loans are a lot, but not that much. So I think it's very important. And with COVID and everything happening, while it may seem to some people it hasn't helped, it does help. Knowing what is going on around the world, it's like anything, you need your allies when it comes to even like military, when it comes to military action, to political action, you need your allies and who you can go to. That's the same with health. It doesn't change. You need your allies to know who you can go to in case you need more supplies for research, more whatever you need. Well, now that we've talked a lot about things that are happening that are not so good and that are very controversial, I think we'll slide into the more happier and good news segment. So, Shamira, do you want to start with a story?
Yeah, so I'll start. So there was, I read a story the other day on Instagram, and it was about this woman who was from Jersey City in New Jersey, and she bought a fridge and stocked it for anyone who needed food to take what they need, and anyone who wants to donate can too. She was quoted saying, "No one should go hungry during a pandemic." So she bought food for people in her community. She wanted to feed them, whoever was struggling, and so she brought this this refrigerator, like kind of like one you'd see if you went into a grocery store and you had to pull open the fridge to get like milk or something. She bought something similar to that, and she stocked it with a bunch of food, frozen food. So I thought this was amazing because, I mean, it's so selfless. At a time like right now where people are really struggling to get by, the unemployment rate is so high, and I think it's really thinking about others at a time when, you know, people are really, really, really just out here just trying to survive. So I thought this was such a great story.
We're all taking it day by day. At least I know I am. Just not day by day, baby steps. So that's definitely a really nice story to hear. Let's see. I think I'm going to try and talk of a good story, a good decision the government made, just because we've talked about so many things that politically and government-wise are not going so good. But government-wise, and this is actually about 2 to 3 weeks old, I believe. I keep on losing count of the days because I don't know. I've been in home for like 4 months now, so I don't know what day it is. All I know
is welcome to quarantine life.
I know. All I know is I go to school back in a month, in 3 weeks. That's all I know. Other than that, I'm like lost in time. But a couple of weeks ago, there was a huge controversy regarding international students and whether they could stay in the U.S. because there is a ruling in their contract, I guess you can say, where they are not allowed to take full online classes. They have to take in-person classes, and obviously that became a dilemma during the pandemic because a lot of schools are going fully online. My school is going fully online. We're doing about half and half, but other schools, in several schools in California, several schools in Harvard, they're going full-time online. So that created the dilemma of them having to go back to their home country, which majority of these people being in coming from China or India. So the schools decided to step up, and 17 schools actually, including DC, I believe, sued the Trump administration for this because they evidently wanted their students to stay here. And the same day that the lawsuit happened, the same day it was overturned and an injunction was put in place. And for this remaining year, the fall semester at least, they will be allowed to stay here even if they have full online classes. So I think that to me was very refreshing because I think it reminds us that at the end of the day, we are focused on the people, the system, the government. We are focused on the people, and we do want to help. They do want to help the people. I think we've gained a lot of mistrust as the years have gone by because of political animosity and all of these sort of things. But I think that was really enlightening to see that.
I think that's such a great positive note to leave on, because you're right. I just couldn't imagine being in that position where I'm being told that because of a pandemic, it's something that's out of my control. I can't control what's going on. But if the school decides to go virtual and not have anyone on campus to try to protect their faculty, their staff, their students, that those students who were international students will be penalized for that. I think that that is just so wrong in so many different ways. And it's not the choice of the students, it's the choice of the school, and they have to do what's best for the people that attend that school, so, or even work at that school. You know, you want to try to protect your people, especially when some places have already experienced such great loss, right?
Yes.
So I do think that for the schools as well, you have to imagine, like, if these kids did have to stay in their own country and do schoolwork there, you have to think some people, like you said, are from China or India. That's a 12, 13 hour time difference. I mean, is that really reasonable? Right. So, I mean, realistically, like, it just didn't make any sense. These kids would have to find another school, and, you know, then the schools would be losing money, right?
Yes.
So that's another thing to think about. So I definitely agree with the overturning, and I think that the schools did the right thing standing up to the administration saying, absolutely not. We can't penalize people for a pandemic. You know, they deserve an education. They deserve to be able to come back and stay here until, who knows, in January we could open, you know?
So we don't know. Nobody knows.
That's such a positive note to leave on, and I think that's great. Yeah,
I think so. And hopefully we'll, you know, eventually, I think for the rest of the year, we'll all be honest, we'll have to wear masks. I think we'll all eventually get used to it. Like I said, I enter my car. It's so funny. My car, instead of having like a photo hanging on my rear view mirror, I have like three masks hanging in there. Two for me and an extra one, clean one, because you never know who needs a mask. So yeah. It's really interesting how times have changed and how we've sort of evolved through this pandemic and created a new definition of normal. But yeah, I think we're good. Shamira, any other good stories?
I think I have one more for you. A really sweet story about a doctor in India who volunteered to care for an infant for a month while their parents were recovering from COVID and the family was in quarantine. So the baby just reunited with the parents, and it's just such a sweet story that this doctor volunteered to take care of the infant while the parents were recovering. And I just thought it was so sweet. And we just need more people like this in the world. And we just need more stories like this, positive stories, positivity. We need to put that out in the universe because it's really what everyone needs.
We need more politicians like this. But we'll see. And speaking of that, before ending everything, just want to remind everyone to vote, that we are, I believe, 96 yep. or 95 days yep. from the primaries, from presidential voting and all of that shenanigans during this pandemic, which is a lot in itself. But don't forget to vote. It is very powerful. It is something that we need to exercise. And it is our little, I think, way of contributing to change and contributing to how we want, where we want our children to grow and where we want to study and where we want to get to. So before closing this, I just wanted to say, don't forget to vote.
Thanks for joining us today, and make sure to follow us on Twitter at WhatUpPH or email us at whatsuppublichealth@gmail.com if you have any topics that you would like for us to cover. Please don't forget to leave us a 5-star rating wherever you listen to us. Until next time, thanks for listening.